Brought to you by Black Knight, it's the technology.ie podcast, episode 45 for October 4th, 2012, with Michaela Nealon and Conor Muinnechon. Dias Marivagas, Kit Faltarovistach. Hello and welcome to technology.ie. This is Conor Muinnechon in the Edgecast Media Studios. Technology.ie podcast is brought to you by Black Knight. And as usual, my co-host, Black Knight CEO Michaela Nealon, is on the line. Good evening, Michaela.
Good evening, Con. How's it going?
It's going well. This is take two because we had a little snafu there with our first attempt at recording this. Thankfully, we didn't have too much to throw away and start again. So we're getting going with take two on our podcast tonight. Introduce our guest this week, please, Michaela.
Sure. And this week we're joined by Patrick Donaldson from ICM Registry. ICM are the guys behind the .XXX domain extension that launched less than a year ago. And they're always going to be a bit in the news, and they're in the news at the moment because they just launched search.XXX.
Welcome to technology.ie, Patrick.
Thank you, Con. Thank you, Michaela. Pleasure being here.
Good. We'll talk to you more about search.XXX and some of the other news in relation to that in part two of the show this week, and lots of other items to talk about on the show as well tonight as well. Some of them from technology.ie, some of them from around the web. And Michaela, you've done your research this week and picked out an interesting story that you thought I'd be interested in, certainly, for story number one. Irish language at risk of digital extinction, research shows. That's the headline from Silicon Republic. Heaven forbid, Michaela. What's this story about?
Well, it's you know, the title says it all. I mean, you know, the Irish language, it's a minority language. And, you know, because it's a minority language, it isn't spoken by that many people, comparatively speaking. So the digital footprint is lower. And, you know, the articles, it's all around this white paper that's been produced by a bunch of academics from Trinity and NUIG and a couple of other places. And they're just talking about the digital aspect of us, you know, and its footprint.
So it's to do with, I suppose, the amount of content that's published in Irish online. It's to do with the amount of resources that are available in Irish online, I suppose. It's a banner that I've been carrying for years, Michaela, and as you probably know, one of the reasons and one of the motivators for me getting involved in online activity, I started a blog in 2004 and moved into podcasting in 2005. And one of the motivators for that was that I was interested in finding material published in the Irish language, and couldn't necessarily find enough material to satisfy my demand from mainstream publishing. And I thought that, well, user-generated content and online communities and things like that provided the answer. And to a certain extent, they have. But this is casting a kind of a critical eye on this and suggesting that for languages such as Irish, and I quote from the article, with relatively few speakers, it's difficult to acquire the critical mass, the needed mass of data, I suppose, to make it all sustainable. What we're talking about here really is a problem which I suppose is associated with languages with a very small footprint or a very small density of speakers, such as the Irish language, such as a number of European languages as well, Michaela. And this is a European. This report, I think, is in a European context, and some of the things quoted in this report in Silicon Republic are looking at things from a point of view of a European context. Dr. John Judge is quoted from the Centre for Next Generation Localization based in Dublin City University, saying that there must be a coordinated approach at European and national level to safeguard minority languages. He says a wide-ranging coordinated effort focused on language technologies would help safeguard the future of the Irish language together with other languages and establish a genuine multilingual agenda for Europe and the world as a whole. Europe and Ireland, he says, must take action to prepare its languages for the digital age. They're a precious component of our cultural heritage and as such deserve future proofing. Now, you know what, Michaela, I agree with that, but I'm not sure exactly what's being advocated in this report or by Dr. Judge or other people involved here as well. In many respects, and in my experience, I have to say that minority languages are not doing too badly online. If people choose to use them, it's easier to find, as I was suggesting earlier, it's easier to find minority language speakers, people who share your language. It's easier to do that online, such as others. And indeed, one of the beautiful things, I think, about the online experience is the fact that you can you can use your own language without excluding others. And one of the greatest examples of that is Facebook. And I think it would be interesting to discover, and I know there has been some research done on this, who chooses to use the Irish language interface, for example, or whatever, insert a language here interface for Facebook. Very often I find that at different times I use the Irish or the English language interface, but it doesn't matter. I'm using one interface, you're using another, and it doesn't matter from that point of view. And I know a lot of people who use Irish language on Facebook in particular, as I say, and you know, they'll post something in Irish, they'll post something in English. Very often, and you'll find this with native speakers and people from Irish language communities, they'll post a patois or a kind of a Creole or a mixture of languages, depending on who they're talking to and what it's about. And it can be interesting to see somebody post something in one language and find comments turn up in both languages, depending on their friends and who they're actually speaking to. I'm not so pessimistic about this, Michaela. Would you feel that perhaps this report might be overreacting just a little?
I honestly don't know, Colin. I mean, I just thought it was kind of interesting. Yeah. I mean, I wasn't going to, you know, get too bogged down in it. I just thought,
but you knew I would, though, didn't you?
Well, of course, yeah. I knew you would. That's why I threw it in there. But, I mean, the thing is, I mean, you know, I've an interest in language, as you know, and I've had a kind of a love-hate relationship with the Irish language since I was a child. I mean, just for Pat's benefit, we're all force-fed it from an early age. Though most of us don't actually speak it. No, I think, you know, I think it's interesting. It's an interesting report, but whether you know, I think there's a lot of stuff going on. I mean, you look at TG Cahir, you look at, there's a lot of stuff being produced, and as you say, some people are using that. But I mean, if we want to talk about language, what about pirate? I mean, I switched my interface on Facebook to pirate for the pirate to speak like a pirate day, and that was much more fun.
Or pig Latin.
I couldn't do that one now because I couldn't actually understand the pig Latin. I tried it.
Yeah, so. No, the rules of pig Latin are fairly simple, but it can be very tricky. But it's a real geeky thing, definitely, without a doubt. But yeah, you can switch the Facebook interface to pirate. Elmer Fudd, I think, is available on Google as well as a language interface, or at least it used to be back in the.
Well, I'm just looking here on Facebook at the moment. Is pirate there as an option? I think they've taken pirate off again.
No, perish the thought.
Ah, no, don't tell me that. They've got Lingua Latina, which I think is very... Oh, they've got Leetspeak. Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, they've got English Pirate, English Upside Down. Now, that would hurt my head. I think I'd actually... I think you'd be permanently convinced that you were drunk.
I have to say, Michaela, and I'm not trivializing this report in any way, and I certainly haven't looked into the details of it, but I think the situation for minority languages is healthier now, perhaps due to online media, than perhaps it ever would have been, because it does give you that opportunity to exercise your linguistic muscles in whatever particular language that you may not be getting the chance to do that in. And specifically in relation to the Irish language, Michaela, if you go back 15 years, 16 years now before the launch of TG Cahir, which is the Irish language television station here in Ireland, Patrick. If you go back before that and compare the time then to now, if you look at, for example, Radio Reraw, which is an Irish language radio station, which started, it's run by young people, it's run by teenagers and young adults. It started in Dublin City in the... it started a few years back, and it started online with an occasional. Occasionally, they'd get a license to broadcast, maybe on FM for about a week or so. As far as I know, I think that's gone on. That's going now full time online, or full time as a radio station in Dublin, volunteer, community run, and run by young people. And all of this is the general media situation, the likes of TG Cahir and what it has done for the Irish language. It's all a much healthier situation now than it was 10, 15 years ago. And online has been a big part of that. Apps, social media, mobile media, it's all good as far as I'm concerned. Let's move on. Let's look at some of the other stories we want to talk about this week on the podcast. And this next one is interesting because it's of interest as well, given that we have Paul on from Triple X and ICM Registry. And Pat, I should say. And Paul we've had on before. That's Paul Walsh, of course, who is a compatriot of our own here in Ireland, and CEO of a company called MetaCert. Describe again for us what MetaCert have done in relation to .XXX, Michele, and what they've just launched.
Well, I think Patrick will probably speak more in detail about what they've done for .xxx. What they've done here with this new browser, which they're calling Ollie, is it's a child-safe browser. I mean, it's child-safe, it's family-safe. I mean, if you actually look at some of the options you can enable on it, you could even use it, say, as a kind of a work-safe browser, because you can disable access to adult content, you can disable access to social networks, you can block access to specific social networks, to specific sites. I mean, you can set up a whole range of filters on it. And the entire thing, you know, it's for the iPad, and it's free. And the other interesting thing is that it doesn't track your activity.
Oh, that's interesting.
Which I thought was kind of interesting. I don't know. Patrick, have you played around with this at all?
Not the Ollie so much, but I have played around a lot with MetaCert if you download it in your Firefox browser. And I think it's a fantastic piece of software.
We've provide a little bit of background here. We've had Paul Walsh on before, and Paul has been working for years in relation to the whole notion, I suppose, Michaela, correct me on the science of this if I'm wrong, but his interest is in relation to certifying websites and building a database of websites that meet particular criteria, and in this particular instance, a database of websites that can be defined as adult or pornographic in nature. And he's partnered with you guys in ICM Registry. Patrick, he's partnered with you guys from very early on because this is something, obviously, you're interested in building this top-level domain which is exclusively for adult content. And part of the definition of being exclusively for adults is that you want to exclude and provide people with a mechanism for excluding people that don't want to see such content, be they minors or whomever doesn't want to see such content. You want to facilitate that, and that's why you've worked with MetaCert.
Absolutely. Every single XXX website is labeled with a MetaCert tag. So it's if you institute the technology and it's on your browser, it's impossible to find a site without a password. So, and with XXX, obviously, we all know what we're looking for if you hit XXX at the end of any extension. But this actually makes parents or anyone else not wanting to see the content at ease.
Absolutely, and so they've built this massive database of websites and web pages, and I know they've made browser plugins and that available for that up until now. And this is really the radical or the logical next extension of this is of making an entire browser available on iPad. And certainly something that I'm interested in, Michaela, I've got to say, you know, we want to put technology in the hands of our kids. My kids are aged 8, 6 and 5, and they are into computers, digital technology, games, and they're interested in visiting the web and going to websites and things like that. We've got a laptop in the sitting room which they use, and that's all fine and cool. But you know, from the point of view of supervising what they access, and I've had other people, you know, with kids of similar age saying this same thing to me as well. We want to be able to control access and to especially for young children in particular. So this is interesting, and again, I guess for many people, you know, putting it into their hands is going to be, you know, an iPad is very often a very friendly way for kids to access the internet. I presume they're going to extend this out, Michele, to other platforms besides the iPad as well.
I think so. I mean, I was in the beta of this for the last couple of months. I mean, you know, officially speaking, I was testing it. I mean, I did do a small bit of testing, but to be perfectly honest, there's only so many hours in the day. I think from what I can recall, they were planning on offering it on other platforms and maybe extending it out beyond that. But I mean, starting with the iPad, you know, a single device, single type thing, there was a lot of sense in that. So we'll see what happens.
I mean, we will. And we're going to have, we're going to invite Paul on again soon. I think you mentioned that in the blog post also.
Well, yeah, I mean, we had initially said that we'd have him on sometime around this month. When, I don't know, but I mean, we'll get to him eventually. Talking of Apple devices, the other thing was the launch of iOS 6, which I think which everybody talked about.
Talked about it last week, and we talked in particular about the Maps fiasco, and I was a little harsh on Apple.
Well, you were, but you're not an Apple fanboy.
No. And I may have been overly harsh. You were inclined to be a little bit more understanding, I think, Michaela, which it's your nature, of course, naturally. Tim,
my nature to cause trouble, but I was trying to be understanding.
Apple boss apologizes for iOS 6 maps. Tim Cook has come out, and really, this is an unprecedented. Almost grovelling apology. He's even gone and said, listen, why don't you go and use Google Maps or something in the meantime?
It's extraordinary. I don't know. Patrick, do you have an iPhone or what are you using?
I do use an iPhone. And I mean, I thought the criticisms were kind of harsh, to be honest. I use the Apple platform maps or, you know, whatever it's called, just over the weekend. I thought the directions worked just fine, and the location that I was looking for, it popped right up when I searched for it. So I'm not sure if in Florida they have it in, you know, done very well with locating different areas of interest, but I'm completely fine with it. And, you know, it's still a work in progress, but you got to give new technology chances. You can't just be Google all of a sudden.
Somebody made the point here that Google has a good head start here, and in fact, the initial releases of Google Maps and even the Apple Map version on the very first iPhone, which used Google data and which has used Google data up until this release, initially Google weren't doing that well at it either, Michaela, were they?
Well, I mean, look, you know, anything like this is going to take time to build up a decent data set. I mean, okay, fine, Patrick's over in the US and he's not having any problems. you know, whereas I'm here in Carlow, and I've actually got it open here on my phone.
You hadn't tried it when we spoke last, so you've
no, I hadn't upgraded. I mean, yeah. I hadn't upgraded, and I hadn't had a chance to do it. Now,
so what's the verdict?
I live literally across the road from one of the few hotels in Carlow town. It ain't on the map,
right?
It's not there. Now, I know if I fire up Google Maps, it'll be there. If I fire up Nokia Maps, it'll be there. I can't actually use the iPhone app maps to navigate to hotels or other points of interest in Ireland. It might work in the US.
Now, in relation to that, though, Michaela, in fairness, that data is often user-generated, isn't it? People add in, and Google has the head start here in terms of users sticking pins in the map and saying, yes, this is my hotel, I want to stick a pin so I'll remember it again. Sure, share it with other users if you want.
Yeah, that's great, Con, but try to actually get from point A to point B.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the problem.
Well, let's look at the basic stuff, Michele. Does it have the street names correct? Does it have yes. anything else? Does it pick out major features in Carlow town or anything like that? No?
No.
No. So premises, businesses, public buildings, things like that, not on the map. Well, that's...
Well, I'm looking at it now. If I actually move a bit closer to the town itself, I am seeing some things, but they're actually wrong. Mm. I mean, it's saying Carlow Cash Registers. Now, I know that Carlow Cash Registers isn't actually called Carlow Cash Registers, and I also know that they moved from that location, oh, I don't know, 4 years ago. they've also got Carlow First and Kilkenny Advertiser, and they moved, oh, I don't know, 3 years ago. Mm. Tyler Ireland, never even heard of it. They've also managed to put restaurants and things like that in the middle of nowhere. I mean, they're not actually on... Well, these are actually not even on streets, which I'm quite impressed by that.
I'm quoting here from Tim Cook's open letter here, which is, as we say, uses the phrase extremely sorry for the frustration it has caused. And that, and really, as I said, it's an unprecedented tone of an apology, I think, in many respects. But he does point out that there are already more than 100 million iOS devices using the new Apple Maps, more and more joining us every day. In just over a week, iOS users with the new maps have already searched for nearly 500 million locations. And he makes the point that the more our customers use our maps, the better it will get. And we greatly appreciated all of the feedback we're receiving from you. So we're going to see, but isn't that a fair point, Michaela? We're going to see the impact of that user feedback sooner rather than later, perhaps.
Well, maybe. But I mean, for God's sake, at the moment I'm seeing Le Trek's restaurant in Carlow on the wrong bloody street.
Yeah.
I mean, I can actually see it. It's just not there. I mean... The little icon is in the wrong place completely. I mean, look, we'll see what happens.
Patrick, there are a lot of things that Apple doesn't do. There are a lot of games they don't play. There are a lot of areas that they don't operate in. There are a lot of things they've tried and failed at. And I'm, as a case in point off the top of my head, Ping, their social network they tried to build into iTunes, I think is being wound down, shut down this week. So, you know, despite that, they're still the most profitable and the most successful company that came from nowhere just four or five years ago with the iPhone to completely revolutionize the mobile market. There is an argument, Patrick, is there not, that people have made, and I think, Michaela, you made it as well, which is that, okay, they can afford to make a few mistakes, they can afford to not do everything right, and ultimately it's not going to hurt them.
That's an excellent point. I mean, it really comes down to, Michaela, how long are you going to be upset about this before you make a switch? Or will you ever make a switch?
Oh, I won't be making a switch. I mean, don't worry. I mean, I'm just going to use an alternative way of finding my way from point A to point B.
Okay, gotcha.
You know, it's not like, you know, this has annoyed me so much that I'm going to rush out and buy an Android phone.
Right.
That's not going to happen. That is not going to happen. I'll tell you why. It's very simple. I sign in with my Apple ID onto my iPhone. Sign in my Apple ID onto my iPad. I sign in on my MacBook Air. I sign into one of my iMacs. You notice a trend here. You know, it's like everything I have is Apple. They all work together. They all talk together. They play nice together.
That sounds like the argument.
Exactly.
That sounds like the argument, Michaela, that people make for staying in the Google environment. And I do that on my Android Samsung Galaxy Ace phone. You know, so and listen, it's worth saying it from this point of view. You guys that don't have Android maps, that don't have Google Maps on Android, and don't have the Google Navigation on Android, maybe. And again, you know, we're siloed in our individual environments now, perhaps up to a point, but. This is a very, very good product, a very successful product. And I navigated my way around a holiday in France last month, Michaela, with the help of this.
And you can still use Google Maps or Nokia Maps on your iPhone. It's just, you know, you can basically, like what I've heard a few people are doing is they've just either moved or hidden the Maps icon on their home thing, screen on their iPhone, and replaced it with something else.
What about that point, though, you're raising, Michele, that, you know, you're invested in iPhone, you're invested in iOS, I'm invested in Android. There's a bit of inertia there now when it comes to getting people to make the switch, isn't there?
Well, that's always going to be the case. I mean, it's like when you look at, you know, taking, say, you know, the likes of Aircom versus other providers for phones or DSL and things like that. I mean, people aren't going to switch unless they're given a very good reason to do so.
Mm. Or
the thing with mobile phones, it's very easy. You know, I used to be a Nokia fanboy. I had Nokias for years. Mm. I was very, very reluctant to switch away from Nokias, but, you know, Nokia didn't keep up. I switched over to an iPhone. Sorry, I'm losing my train of thought completely.
Patrick, are you exclusively iPhone? Would you switch for any reason? What would it take?
I don't know. I'm pretty much in Michaela's camp. I have Apple everything from Apple TV to iPhone to iMac. I mean, everything's within an Apple ID. Everything I purchase is right there. I will say, though, that our COO, Tony Farrow, came in on his high horse and said, you know what, I'm switching phones. I'm getting the Galaxy Samsung, I'm not sure what it's called, the Samsung Galaxy C or whatever it is, the new one.
There are loads of them, yeah.
Yeah, and he's only had it for a week and he's switching back.
I have to confess. Yeah, go ahead.
It was just one of those things. I mean, we're just an Apple office and he liked it because he's more into, he thinks that the Samsung has better features for Gmail and things like that he manages his contacts. But at the end of the day, he just literally today he just came up. He goes, "Yeah, I'm going to switch back." Like, okay,
well,
fair enough.
I have to confess that I forced myself to switch to Android for research purposes at one point, and I forced myself for a good 3-4 months to carry both phones with me because I found that I just wasn't getting. I found it very frustrating. I couldn't write a text, for example, on the Android I had at the time. Not as good as the Samsung Galaxy phone I have now, but even at that, it was a wrench to tear myself away from iOS. But what I find now, actually, is when I pick up an iPhone, guys, you know, I find I can't use it. I'm looking for the back button. I'm trying to get my there's a few features, I suppose, of the Android environment that I find a miss when I pick up an iPhone now. So again, it's there is that inertia when it comes to switching over, and sometimes you have to push yourself to do it, and again it depends on whether or not the rewards are there for that. Let's move on. Michele, you've blogged this week on technology.ie about app.net. Speaking of disruptive, speaking of providing alternatives to the dominant players in a particular area, just to remind listeners again, app.net is an alternative to Twitter, where they're inviting people to actually pay to use it, but they're reducing that cost now, Michele.
Yeah, they've dropped the prices on the annual subs, and they've also introduced a new monthly subscription. I mean, the rationale they're using is that they'd originally based their pricing on having 10,000 signups. They've had 20,000. So they go, hey, yeah, we can drop the price. The only thing that isn't clear is, you know, if, let's say, they end up with 100,000 users or 200,000 users, are they going to keep on dropping the pricing?
They've got a long way to compete with the price on Twitter, though, don't they?
Well, this is it. I mean, you know, it's... I mean, I've got an app.net account now, as we know.
Yeah.
And
have you been there lately?
No, I'm logging in now, actually. I mean, they're starting to send email notifications when people follow you and a few other bits and bobs, which are kind of useful, because I was finding it, you know, bizarre.
Is there anybody there?
Oh, there are people there. Whether you want to know who's there or not is another question. I mean,
compare it to Google Plus, for example, which I find pretty uncompelling as well, even though I think it's beautiful. And I every time I go in there, I think, yeah, this looks nice. This ought to be a good way to react with people. But there's nothing going on. There's no conversation going on, despite all the people I follow in there that I think are interesting. They're just not posting their interesting stuff onto Google Plus. Is app.net like that?
I honestly don't know. I mean, I haven't been in there that much recently. I mean, there's a bunch of people in there. There's a lot of people you'd recognize. I mean, what's interesting from my perspective is looking to see which companies have signed up that I'm familiar with in other spaces, be that Google Plus or Twitter or Facebook. And just kind of seeing, you know, what people are at, what's going on. And, you know, some people definitely are there. What's his name? Our American friend is there. What is his name? I'm reading. My brain is not working this evening. Sorry, Con. I mean, there's a bunch of people I recognize.
Yeah, but are they talking? Are they posting? Is there anything?
There's a few of them who are, but it's not. It's not quite. It hasn't really reached that kind of volume where I kind of go, yeah, I must check in there to see what's going on.
Patrick, the basic idea here is that you've got Twitter, which doesn't charge you anything. In other words, you're not a paying customer. In fact, you're the product, and they're selling your attention to advertisers, and that's how Twitter works. App.net is for people who are uncomfortable with that, and they say, don't be the product, be the customer. Come in here and pay us an annual fee. Is that a model that's got any traction? Is that going to work?
You know, I don't know. This is the first I've really heard of it.
Yeah.
You know, I try out different. Anytime there's a new platform to the new thing, I try to. You know, I feel like I find myself getting older and crankier if I don't know what's out there. And you know, app.net, I guess, is a new one I'll try and check out. Maybe I'll Well,
it's saying a lot that you haven't tried it or that you haven't heard of it up until now, I think, Patrick. And from my from my own point of view, Michele, as I said, I'm like you, and I'm interested in researching these things for the show and stuff like that. I've got to admit, I haven't even visited the app.net website, not to mind signed up first. So again, thanks for taking the hit, so I don't have to there, Michele, and signing up for app.net, and it is appreciated. Next on the agenda we were going to talk about tonight is some stuff in relation to Black Knight yourself, but let's leave that until we do our promotional stuff, Michele, if that's okay with
you.
Yeah,
that's fine.
And we'll walk on Wall of Tweets at Debate Denver is the headline on a website, UX Passion. What's this about, Michele?
Wall of Tweets, it's what's interesting here is that, well, there's a couple of things. First off, as I've mentioned a couple of times on the technology.ie blog over the last couple of months, and we've also spoken about it on the podcast, there's a lot of social media activity around the US elections this year. Patrick, oddly enough, is American, so he can actually speak to this. And what's interesting is that tonight in the US, there's the big debate between the two candidates, and there's going to be social media interaction. They've chosen this Wall of Tweets product. But what makes it really interesting is Wall of Tweets is from a small company in Zagreb, in Croatia.
Okay.
It's not some big, you know, massive US-based company. It's actually a small little startup in Zagreb. Vibor Sipan, or I'm not sure, I think that's how you pronounce his name, was speaking at Webfest in Montenegro the other week, and he was there last year as well. And the Wall of Tweets product was actually in use during the conference over the 2 days, both this year and last year. And it's kind of cool, because what they'll do is they aggregate tweets based on hashtags and other things, but they also pull in things like Foursquare activity, so you can see who else is actually there. And it's all projected up on a nice big screen, so if you're in the room, you can see it. But I just thought to myself, you know, this is really interesting that, you know, first off, you've got the social aspect of it. Secondly, you've got this small little startup. I mean, this, you know, it's a small little group of guys in Zagreb, of all places. And they're the guys who are powering the Wall of Tweets for the US presidential debate. I thought to myself, that's cool.
Patrick, social media, Twitter in particular, I imagine, and Facebook, I guess, as well. It's really taken hold, hasn't it, in American politics?
Oh, my God. you know, I don't really, you know, on Facebook, I feel like 75% of my friends are political experts all of a sudden. You know, they read an article in the Washington Post and they say they're one way or the other. If Romney or President Obama say get caught in a Pinocchio scale on the Washington Post, they're posting that immediately on one side or the other. I mean, it's like nothing I've ever seen before. You know, I'm sure both of you have American friends that possibly have tweeted or mentioned something on Facebook about it already.
Oh, yeah.
You just sit there and scratch your head. You're like, oh, my God. And then what I love to do is actually read the follow-up comments see them go back and forth. I just sit there and just, you know, scratch my head and just – it's actually quite enjoying.
Do you participate, Patrick, or are you you know, I imagine some people are more comfortable discussing politics in general and perhaps discussing it in the social media circles. Or do you feel that – how do you feel about it? Do you get stuck in, or do you say, no, this is for sharing recipes and posting things on Pinterest and not for politics?
I definitely don't think it's for politics, but I definitely love being a fly on the wall and listening to us. Just seeing what's going on. I mean, honestly, it entertains me so much. It's you know, it's getting quite old as of late, but I'm sure the debates tonight will stir it up quite a bit. So I'm looking forward to all the conversations.
And it's a worldwide thing, really. I mean, Michele, I remember participating in a media interview about 3-4 years ago where I was asked for my opinion on, I think it was local elections were running at the time, and whether social media was going to play a role in it. And I said no, not significantly, you know, at the time. And that was certainly the case. But that really has changed. Could you say, Michele, perhaps over the past year, we had a Twitter incident with a fake tweet on a TV show that changed the course of a presidential election here last year, Michele. We've had Roisin Shortall's political resignation from the government last week, and that tweeted as well. And in fact, a lot of comments circling on. I think at some point I was reading a political blog or a political report in a newspaper, and it was all about what the response and reaction of various elected representatives were and what they were tweeting about.
Well, this is it, Colin. I mean, it's I don't know when it happened. I'm not sure what the sea change was. I think the change was driven by the Obama election in the US. Mm. Because if you remember, you know, Obama was the first politician who really went to town on the social media, the web and everything else, and you know, engaged with potential electors. And if you remember that thing, the company, I can't remember the name of them now, is it Blue Media or Blue?
That's right. And they were then hired by Fianna Fáil, political party in this country, Michele, weren't they?
Yeah, I mean, they were hired. Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of stuff. It was like, you know, how politicians should be using stuff. I mean, it's really kind of taken off. I mean, earlier this evening, one of our ministers, instead of sending me an email, a text message, or phoning me, he tweeted me saying, "Could I ring him tomorrow?" I mean, he didn't send me a direct message; he just sent me a tweet.
Right.
You know, can we catch up tomorrow? And I'm like, "Yeah, sure, fine, no problem." you know, I'll choose the worst time of the day to contact you. I'll wait until there's some crazy debate going on the dial, then I'll ring him. But you know, it has changed completely. I mean, you know, you look at say the media. I mean, mainstream media, both Irish and international. Look at how they're using social media. How they're polling people for their opinions. How they're gauging stuff. I mean, remember the Amazon thing? I don't know whether you saw, if you remember that, Con.
You showed that was really interesting. It was a heat map of the United States, wasn't it? Showing which. What kind of political biographies were being bought, whether they were biographies of Romney or Obama, literally, or Republican or Democratic candidates, wasn't that it?
It was kind of right. It was whether they were more right or left.
Okay, yeah.
And then Facebook and CNN launched another thing as well. I mean, it's the Amazon election heat map 2012. That was it. Daily political book sales. And you can go in, you can see what the percentage is. So, I mean, just looking at it now, this minute, it's 43% blue, 57% red.
Yeah. Patrick, can I ask you something now, if you don't mind me asking? Just as you say, as an American living in the United States, from where we are here, we often, and I hear commentary to this effect coming from the United States as well, that in the last few years, perhaps going back to President Bush, President Bush's defeat of John Kerry, wasn't it John Kerry? It was, wasn't it? Going back to the election where I think where Bush was first elected, over the last number of years, people say that politics in the United States has become more aggressive, more polarized, that the gap between the Democratic and Republican parties has widened, that the ideologies have hardened, and that it's become a more bitter and a more I suppose, aggressive and hostile battle between the different ideologies in the United States. Do you think that's accurate in your view, Patrick? And if it is, do you think it's possible that social media and the internet has played a role in that?
Spot on right there with social media. I mean, I'm a fly on the wall in these conversations, and I've seen literally lost friendships happen on Facebook when they go back and forth, and all of a sudden, nope, that looks like they're not friends anymore. I mean, it's just like the craziest thing I've ever seen. So yes, it's been crazy in the last few years. I remember the Bush-Gore election, John Kerry, that's what it was.
No, you're right, it was Bush-Gore, actually, it was. I beg your pardon.
Yeah.
Oh, so, no, it was Kerry for the re-election, wasn't it?
Who cares? There were two politicians.
It was Kerry.
Two white guys probably arguing.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, back then it was just kind of like, you know, I was in college during the, just getting out of college during the Kerry election. So it just wasn't on the radar for someone in my demographic at the time. But now it just seems like it's on everyone's radar this year. Everyone's an expert, and it is polarizing. It's mind-blowing. That's why I sit there as a fly on the wall. I mean, I don't think social media has definitely played an impact on this, no question. Because back then, everyone was anonymous posting back and forth, so it was kind of like you didn't know who was talking to each other. Mm-hmm. But people were putting their names behind all this stuff, and it's an entertainment, man.
It's interesting because, Michele, if we then say that, you know, what America does first, we do soon after. And in the case of the social media's impact on politics there, we're now manifesting that here. But I wonder if we'll see a similar drive towards more polarity, more hostility, I think, is what I pick up from American politics. And it's, as I say, and it's also more ideologically driven. And that's not something we've really been associated with in this country, is any strong adherence to ideologies.
Oh, come on, for God's sake, Tom. It's not as if we even have them to begin with. You know,
you can argue that, and you can say that, you know, whereas other nations divide along right-left lines, and typically in this country we've had pretty much our politics has been determined by a civil war that happened almost 100 years ago. You know, that has been more of a tribal and more of a sort of, you know, I vote the way my parents voted, and that's the kind of thing it is, rather than being associated with any particular ideology. But what I'm suggesting to you, Michele, is that we now have what we didn't have, say, 10, 15, 20 years ago. We now have all of this debate and discussion on ideological grounds happening in the United States, and we have it here in Ireland as well. There's a lot of very, very vigorous political debate going on in online circles here in Ireland as well, isn't there?
Oh yeah, I mean, look, there's a lot goes on. I mean, it's interesting because in some ways, you know, you're seeing journalists using the discussions on Twitter and Facebook and everything else to drive a lot of the stories in the mainstream media. And, you know, I think they're using it just kind of to start debates. But I mean, you know, I think it is interesting. But let's move on.
Let's
talk about guns.
Let's talk about guns, which is a political issue as well.
Yeah, jeez.
Yeah, I don't know if you guys have been following this 3D printing developments, what's been going on in technology from that point of view. There are a number of companies, I think, that working in this area. The idea being that you can get this 3D printer. You can get a set of CAD drawings or a design of something. Essentially, tell your programmer, you know, you can buy a design, or indeed design your own thing on the computer, and then it will print it for you, not a 2D printing on paper, but an actual 3D construction in, I guess, some kind of plastic or something, which it actually constructs layer by layer. We've seen these online, I think, as well. Michele, it's a replicator, is what it is.
Yes.
Star Trek technology.
Star Trek technology come to life, and you posted a thing about a 3D printed gun.
That's right.
Which I thought was entertaining, but somebody else, one of my trademark lawyer's friends, was posting on Facebook earlier about, you know, the copyright issues of this. I mean, what's going to happen when people are able to make carbon copies of things easily?
Well, again, it's going to be a copyright issue, as you say, and people are going to and a patent issue, I suppose. People are going to make certain designs available for free, and people are going to make other designs available with a license. And it'll be interesting to see what that goes. This particular story we've linked to I've linked to an article on Slate, actually. The promise of home 3D printing is that you can construct anything you want from the comfort and convenience of your own living room. And for a group whose mission is to 3D print a working pistol from scratch, however, that promise has been revoked. Defence Distributed, a collective led by UT Austin law student Cody Wilson, has raised $20,000 online in a bid to design and develop the world's first entirely 3D printed gun, which it calls the Wiki Weapon. If it succeeds, not only will it build its own prototype, it'll share the design publicly so that anyone around the world with a 3D printer can print his own pistol. It's sort of the opposite, says Slate, of don't try this at home. Now, we're talking about ideology, Patrick. This is something which is very much ideologically driven, isn't it? The right to bear arms, and the idea that defence technology, that weapons and things like that, shouldn't be the exclusive preserve of the government, that individuals should be able to buy, hold, use guns, and in this case, design and replicate them as well.
Again, this is the first I've seen this today. So I don't.
Well, what do you think what do you think of the implications, Patrick? I mean, it's it is a logic, taking things to a logical conclusion. If you say in principle that people should have a right to bear arms, well, then they should have. You know, these people are arguing they should have the right to make them as well. And I think clarify that the issue or the reason this is in the news, hit the headlines in Slate, as I say, on 2nd of October, is that the company that leased the printer, not sold it, but leased this 3D printer, saw this as a breach of its terms and conditions. And they showed up at Cody Wilson's premises, and they took back the printer and said, "You can't use it for that," is what they said. Now, they said it was based on the legal point that Wilson lacked a federal license for manufacturing firearms. Wilson says he doesn't need a license because he's not planning to sell the weapon, but he is going to go and get a license anyway. It's certainly an interesting story when you know to see technology used in this way, isn't it?
Yes. Absolutely. I mean, the technology is incredible. I'm not we're at XXX, we're, promoters of free expression and, everything you want to do. I mean, on a personal level, I don't really own a gun, so I don't need to make them on a printer or anything like that. But technology is pretty neat.
It is, without a doubt. Michele, it's a story that's, I think, of interest, and we'll link to it as well on the blog there as well. Now, another next story we were going to talk about is one that we were talking, of course, about crowdfunding and things like that. Last week we talked about fundit.ie, we talked about Kickstarter. And another one of those similar ones is Indiegogo, and they've just had their fastest growing campaign, and it's been inspired by something we've talked about recently. In fact, going back a couple of months, Michele, you pointed to, and we talked about on the show, the Oatmeal online comic had done an interesting comic on Nikolai Tesla, who is, I suppose, what was that again? He wasn't a CEO, he was a geek.
Yeah, it was the geek versus CEO thing. I mean, basically, Tesla versus Edison. Edison was CEO. Edison
was a corporate patenting Edison, kind of guy. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Edison went for the money. Tesla was too nice for his own good.
Was and brilliant and is I suppose had been championed, I think, by the Oatmeal arising out of this, and probably a few other comics as well that they had done. Championed really as a geek hero and a technological hero in terms of all of the inventions and stuff like that he had done. And then I missed the intervening part of this, but obviously they decided to launch a campaign called Operation Let's Build a Goddamn Tesla Museum. And over 6 weeks, they raised a grand total of $1.3 million and have set the record, basically, for the fastest growing campaign on Indiegogo.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is kind of cool, because what they're trying to do is to buy this land. It's land and a building and a couple of other bits and bobs where Tesla had had a lab of some kind back in the turn of the century. So I mean, it's not a case of, oh, let's go off and just build a museum. It's actually, let's go off and grab this thing that Tesla was involved with.
Okay.
So this if you want the Wikipedia article about the Tesla's Science Center, it goes into quite a bit of detail about the entire history of the land and everything. It seemingly was never actually finished. And I think now there's pollutants on site or something. I know there's more to it than that. But what's amazing is how quickly they managed to raise that much money. I mean, it's insane.
So a local non-profit group, the Tesla Science Centre at Wardenclyffe, were trying to raise funds to buy the $1.6 million property. The state of New York said they would match whatever they'd managed to raise up to a total of $850,000. So in actual fact, that's $850,000 New York State are going to put in along with this. So they have they've raised a lot. They've raised, as we said, $1.3 million, more than enough to buy this and probably something to develop it as well. So it's very, very interesting indeed, and we'll put a link into that as well there. Finally, let's talk, Michele, about the let's see what we were going to talk about. Oh yes, let's talk about the Black Knight news of the week this week, Michele, and in particular, you're announcing free.co domains for getting business online.
Well, so this is twofold. We're doing two things. One, we're offering .co domains for free to the Getting Business Online users. But and two, we're no longer offering .ie domains for the to the Getting Business Online users.
So the Getting Business Online campaign is continuing, Michaela. I know you launched this well over a year ago. And it's you're partnered with Google and some others?
Google, Unpost, and the County and City Enterprise Boards.
And no longer involved with .ie on this. So .ie is the national, it's the country code top-level domain for Ireland. It's so this is a pretty big step, or this is a pretty significant change to make, Michaela. If you're doing a campaign for getting Irish business online, I presume they can still get a .ie domain, but they'll have to pay for it. You're no longer doing free domains for this. Why have you made such a significant change on this?
Which answer do you want, Con? The diplomatic one, the politically correct one, or something closer to the truth?
Give me the truth, Michele, but be nice.
I'll try. I mean, the reality is that, you know, we work with a lot of domain registries around the world. We're the only ICANN accredited registrar in Ireland. We've got more direct accreditations than anybody else in the Irish market, etc., etc., etc. I mean, we've a lot of experience working with different registries, and most registries will work with us as a registrar. So if I was to turn around to Pat and say, look, Pat, I found, a porn studio in Central Europe, and they want to get a .XXX domain name for every single film they're producing over the next 3 or 4 years, and a .XXX domain for every single actor and actresses in any of those films. I'm sure I could come up with some. He'd come up with some kind of deal to make it attractive for us to do .XXX for that. Probably.
Hmm. He's probably, yes.
Probably. I mean, the idea of me saying to you, hey, I can get you 500,000 .XXX registrations isn't going to upset you now, is it?
No, it is not.
No, I don't think it would.
So what you're describing there is normal kind of customer business relations there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you work together, you make it economically viable for somebody to do something like this.
So does that not work with .ie?
No.
Okay. So from the point of view of a campaign you're running on this scale, getting Irish business online, you've just found that it's not practical to work with them.
No, it's not. I mean, the registry rules are overly restrictive. So the only way you can actually do things with getting business online and offer .ie domains was to narrow the choices down to the absolute bare minimum. In other words, it had to be a very, very close match to the registered business name or to the company name, because otherwise this backwards and forwards with paperwork would mean that, you know, the domains would either not go live quickly enough, or they'd go live and then you'd have to take them down again, which was just wouldn't work. So, you know, working with .co, working with, you know, CoInternet for .co, working with URID for .eu, working with Newstar for .biz, and working with VeriSign for .com, it's much, much, much easier. It's simpler. You can go online. You can choose to register whatever the hell you want, .co, .eu, .biz, or .com. We're giving you that free for a year. Hopefully you renew it. But, you know, it works better for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, I know what you're talking about, and I think anyone who's been in this position as a customer trying to register a domain, the experience of registering, for example, a .com versus a .ie are worlds apart in terms of the amount of paperwork that's required in order to do that. So it's interesting to see this. So essentially, so how does .co differ then in this case? What are they doing for you?
Well, the relation what .co are doing for us, that would be, you know, That's something between ourselves and .co. But, I mean, in terms of, you know, they make it easy for us. I mean, they're working with us on this. You know, it made sense. It was a good choice for us to make. And, you know, .co have managed to, you know, land a couple of big wins over the last few weeks. They just announced there that one of the big UK startup organizations has switched over to using a .co away from a .co.uk or a .com. So, you know, they're an organization that you can work with. And, you know, this makes sense for me.
And in terms of the demand that's out there for .ie domains, you've already pointed out that in the first year of this program that was being run, only about 21% of the companies participating in the Getting Irish Business Online program actually chose a .ie domain.
Yeah, I mean, the take-up was low, mainly because, you know, it was harder for them to get a .ie. So if they just wanted to get online, I mean, this is aimed at businesses that don't have any online presence. I mean, this is not aimed at the people who already have a website, have email, have all of that. I mean, this is aimed at those who are just dipping their toes in the online space.
Yeah, I mean, it's the first step, I think, usually in most cases when you're doing this, is you've got to have some kind of documentation to prove that you're entitled to the .ie domain name, that you have rights to the name that you're trying to register. And for most people, the most common case for that is that you have to go off and register a business name with the company's registrations office if you don't already have one like that. And straight away, there's a disconnect. I can register a .com or a .co and be online, you know, be set up within a couple of hours. But if I have to go and register a business name with the company registrations office, well, I've got to wait for a letter in the post then, don't I?
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about, let's say, if all things being equal, you might be able to get a business registered in a week to 2 weeks.
Yeah.
But you could easily see a situation where that would run to several weeks.
I've got to say, Michaela, there is a value in a .ie. The .ie brand has a certain amount of value. People know it and trust it. I would say, to consumers, to businesses, to people in general, it has a certain amount. I'm not saying a huge amount of value. It has a certain amount of value. You see a .ie and you say, oh, that's one of our own. You may even know that not anyone can just go and register any old .ie, and you may say, well, that's a value too, and you feel a certain amount when you see a website with a .ie value. I think it adds value with a .ie domain name. It adds value to it, and it has a certain there's a certain level of trust associated with it. Having said that, whether or not it's all down to a cost benefit analysis here, whether or not that value is worth the jumping through hoops that's involved here. And in the case of almost 80% of the kind of companies you've described, Michele, 80% of them decided, nah, it might be worth something to have a .ie, but guess what? I can do just fine with a .com.
Exactly. I mean, this is it. I mean, I'm not going to get into this religious argument about the value in it and all that, but ultimately, you know, we're giving a free service for 12 months. That has to work for all parties involved.
Patrick, this is interesting from our point of view, because we did touch briefly last week on this. What the .ie country code domain extension do is, or what it involves really, is that it is, to a certain extent, you know, there's a few hoops to jump through in order to get it. You can't just register it as easy as you can with a .co or a .com. Equally, you can't register a .xxx, Patrick, without producing some kind of paperwork or documentation to confirm that you are an adult business, for example.
That is correct. You do have to jump through a little loophole. We want to verify who you are. So once you register a .xxx name, we actually fire an email off to the registrant contact if the person is not already a member. And the registrant contact will have to verify his or her address and their phone number, because we'll actually give them a call. And once they get the call, they input their PIN and they receive a 16-digit token. Once they receive that token, they have to go back to the registrar and input it in the registrar will have to input it in something called a fifth contact record that's not visible to the public. And once it's token, then basically we match it on each side, so it goes live in the DNS. So we're waiting. We stuff the one side of the ballot with the token. We're waiting for the registrar to stuff it, and once it goes, once there's a match, it will be sent to the DNS and live.
That sounds almost like more trouble than getting a .ie, Michele.
No, it's not. It's actually quite easy.
It's easy. It's literally you register a name, you get the email within a couple minutes, and then you go through a 5-minute process. If you go to our website and click on sponsor community, the actual process is on a video. It's, you know, we said what We're doing what we said we'd do by verifying who our sponsor community is.
So what's your take on this here in relation to this, Patrick? And again, you may feel that you're not fully informed on it, but we have a national country code domain here in Ireland, which is run on a restricted basis. You have to prove who you are if you want to register a personal name. You've got to submit a passport or a scan of a passport or a birth cert or something similar. If you want to register a name for business purposes, you've got to prove that you have a registered business name or a company registered in that name or something similar. Are you familiar with similar schemes in other areas, or do you have any comment on this in relation to .ie?
Obviously that's a bigger loophole than ours, but I mean, I assume that there is a definite reason for them to do this. I'm sure if they could lax up on it, they would, no?
Michele?
Pat, we can have this discussion over a beer in Toronto.
I'm sure they're a fine registry and shouldn't comment anymore, I guess.
I guess so. Michele, I mean, is it fair to say that that your problem isn't so much with the principle involved here as with the practical business working arrangements that are involved, and that it simply doesn't make business sense for you to include .ie in that scheme?
Okay, would you like me to make my blunt statement of the day?
Go right ahead.
If I could drop .ie from our offering, I would, across the board.
I think you said that last week. Do you want to go further?
No, I think that covers it. I mean, the reality is that the amount of headaches and heartache and suffering that we go through being able to register .ie domain names for our clients, it's a limiting factor. I mean, it costs us money, it costs us time to do it properly. If we weren't offering .ie domain names, the company would be significantly bigger. We'd have we'd be much bigger in every single way possible. We'd be in a much better position.
So it comes down to, as you say, the amount of work that's involved. From that point of view, it doesn't justify the benefits, the profit, or the price of these domains. And again, when we talked about this briefly last week, we mentioned the fact that a .co domain is a premium price, I think, to register, and admittedly less paperwork there. But for example, even the .xxx is what are they going for now, Patrick? They were $100 and something, I think, originally.
Well, he doesn't know because it depends on what I charge, not what he charges.
Okay, what are you selling them for, Michele, at the moment?
Hold on, let me double check. I should actually have done a bit of research before I came on the show.
Not to worry, and while you're checking that...
I think Michele's at $150 or something like that.
Okay. It's €90 ex-VAT.
Okay, so in relation to that, I mean, If .ie want to set up a procedure which involves all of this checking and red tape and documentation, and if the public out there are happy to participate and pay for that, then I guess it would be worthwhile. But it has to be viable on a business basis, isn't that it?
It has to be simple. I mean, as a registrar, when you're dealing in larger volumes of names, I look at, say, for example, .com or .co or even .xxx. Mm. I could register, technically speaking, and in terms of my staff's time and everything else, I could register 1,000 or more of those domains in the amount of time it takes to register, say, half a dozen .ies. Mm.
We'll come back to it again.
We're going way over.
Yeah, it is interesting, and I know I've talked to people here, let's say community organisations and people like that here, and you know they say that some people do view the .ie as having a certain cachet, and the fact that for example, you know, if you're a local town council, you can register your town name .ie, and you can be confident in the fact that you're not going to have to get into a bidding war with anyone else because IEDR won't register that to anyone except the valid recognised town council for that area. It can be interesting though, and I'm familiar with some cases or with one case in particular where two development organisations or two organisations in one small village have been arguing over who owns the right to the .ie domain for that village name as well. So, you know, there's lots of ways of looking at this, and it can be argued that the .ie approach doesn't solve these arguments either. So very briefly, Michele, McKayley, getting down to business, you're now offering .co with the Getting Irish Business Online, and that campaign is continuing?
Yes, for the moment, yes.
Okay. Anything else? Sorry, go ahead.
Well, the other thing, which is just mentioning in passing, is in relation to Google AdWords. Google have changed the terms and the way that they're doing the Google AdWords promotions across the board. So both ourselves and pretty much anybody else that we're giving away free credits, we're now offering a kind of a multiplier system. So if you spend 25, you get a coupon from ourselves or from somebody else, you spend 25 euro, and once you've done that, Google will top you up to 100. So you spend 25, get 75 free.
Technology.ie is brought to you by Ireland's premier hosting and domain registration company, Black Knight. Black Knight offer a comprehensive range of hosting and domain solutions for businesses of all shapes and sizes, no matter where they are in the world.
You're listening to Technology.ie, the podcast brought to you by Black Knight. Black Knight CEO Michaela Nealon is with us. Still with us, Michaela?
Just about. Thank God I ate before we came on.
And our guest, Patrick Donaldson. Patrick, what time of day is it in Florida at the moment?
It's currently 1800.
Is it? So you need to go for dinner or you need to knock off. So we won't keep you too much longer. Do appreciate you coming on with us. My name's Conor Muinichon and this is the Technology.ie podcast. And we've invited Patrick on this week. Patrick is the registrar liaison with the ICM registry. Let's start with the ICM registry, Patrick. Remind us again what your company does.
Well, we are the company responsible for the sponsored top-level domain of .XXX, and it is for a sponsor community. And basically, to be a member of the sponsor community, you would either provide adult content, i.e. a webmaster performer, adult performer. You would represent adult providers, so you could be a lawyer and accountant representing them, or you could provide products or services to providers, so you could actually be a domainer or a hosting service as well, to actually have a live website with .XXX.
That's why we have BlackKnight.XXX.
In order to, for what purpose?
Well, it points to the page on our website where you can register .XXX domains.
Oh, I see.
So he is providing a service to the sponsor community, so therefore he is a member.
Okay. Now, bring us up to date, Patrick. .XXX launched last year. There was a sunrise period. There was a land rush period. Where are we at now in terms of .XXX? Is it all systems go?
All systems are go. We launched last year on December 6th. It was a crazy time this time last fall, I must say. This time last year, right in the middle of our sunrise program. We had a fantastic program. For Sunrise, for people in the sponsor community and people outside of it. So our Sunrise program, we gave people the opportunity to actually block their name so they would never have to worry about renewal fees or anything like that. They could pay a one-time fee, verify their trademark, and then their name would never exist in the XXX space. That would be non-adult companies.
That phase is over with, and .XXX is open for business.
Yes, it is. Since last December, currently, as of this stage, we have about 235,000 names under management, and we're well pleased. We've definitely exceeded our expectations.
So, what you're doing, Patrick, is you're offering this service, as you say, to adult websites. You are policing it as well, and we talked about that in relation to MetaCert, for example. Every one of the sites that you have registered in .XXX, every one of those is listed with the MetaCert database and classified as adult content. There's also a deal with McAfee, isn't there, for certifying that sites are virus free.
Yes, absolutely. Every .XXX site is scanned daily by McAfee.
And does that also work for ones which are just redirects, or how does that work?
It's strictly in the .XXX zone.
No, sorry, I'll rephrase that. So would that also, would you also, let's say for example,
if you're redirected to a .com or .net, mm-hmm. I believe, don't quote me on this, but I do believe it's strictly for .XXX.
Okay.
Okay.
So, in relation to that, Patrick, have you found that there has been the uptake from the adult industry in the first place? And on the other hand, are you getting No, we're going to stop that. I'm going to completely rephrase that question because I don't think it's even quite... And again, it's kind of outside of your zone as well, Patrick. I'm not even sure where my thought process was going there.
Do you want me to just ask Patrick questions instead? Will that be easier?
You can do that, yeah. I think we should kind of ask about the search.xxx.
That's what I wanted to do.
Probably, let's get straight into that.
All right.
So you do that.
I will. Okay, so about a week ago, you launched search.xxx.
Yes.
But you're a domain registry. What are you doing getting into the search business? Are you trying to take on Google?
Not exactly. We have to make our TLD relevant and keep it relevant. I think that especially in the new gTLD program coming out, I think a lot of new registries coming on board are going to be faced with the same challenge. So we want to keep our TLD relevant. So the only way to keep it relevant and keep people using it is to get the general public aware of .xxx domain names and let them know of the value adds of the malware scanning, the metacert technology. And the best way to do it is, obviously, we had a massive campaign last year in the fall, but the best way to keep .xxx relevant is to keep consumers happy, keep them coming to the site, and on the flip side, providing traffic to the .xxx sites that are currently our registrants and our sponsor community. If they're seeing traffic, obviously chances for renewal will be higher. So that is why we launched it, and it's specifically for .xxx names. We've currently on the search.xxx platform, we've already crawled 24 million pages, and we're looking to grow that daily.
Okay. And what kind of traffic levels have you seen on the site so far?
Well, in the last week, since last Thursday, we've been very, very pleased. We've seen over 1.2 million visitors since we launched, and that equates to almost 7 million page views, and the average time on site was about 4 minutes. So we're well pleased with that, and we've sent a couple hundred thousand click-throughs to our registrants already, and some are reporting thousands of clicks a day. So very pleased with the preliminary results.
Cool. So I thought was quite interesting was that you had provided quite detailed instructions for webmasters who wanted to get their sites listed, and
yes,
also for ones who didn't want to get their sites listed.
Exactly. You got to give them the option. If they don't want to be listed, we don't really understand why they wouldn't want to be. If they're, you know, we're going to send them traffic through, you know, we call it like a super highway. If they have another website and a .xxx, well, why would they decline traffic from another extension? I mean, hopefully it all converts. So, we're quite pleased with what we have so far.
Yeah, I mean, purely for research purposes.
Of course.
I mean, for research
purposes. Me too.
I mean, you're a married man. And for research purposes, of course, I have spent a bit of time exploring the site. And, you know, for those of our listeners who haven't, for academic research purposes, I would urge you to do so. And I think, but I have to say, of course, it is very much NSFW. I mean, it's not safe for work.
Without a doubt. I've spent about 4 or 5 minutes now researching it, just as you guys were talking just now. I was going to say I Googled, but I didn't, of course, obviously, because it's not Google, it's search.xxx. So I typed in your company name there, Michele, and it's not listed. And that's the kind of thing you're talking about. In a way, you don't want to search out, you don't want to come up on a search on a site such as this.
Well, I don't mind. If they want to go to our website and buy stuff from us, I don't care.
Yeah. But it's not. But in the sense that, and that's a point, I suppose. There, Pat, really, is that this is about people who are going to this site. They're going to be interested to. They're not necessarily looking to find to register domains or anything like that. They're looking for content. They're looking for hardcore content, if you like, and that's what they want to find.
Spain is Spain, and say they're looking for porn.
They are looking for porn, and but which you're not offering. You're not in that business, Michele, as far as I know, and so.
As you know, yes.
So we don't want to see that. We don't want to see you don't necessarily want to rank in a search on this site for the term Black Knight, for example.
Wouldn't bother me.
No,
but then again, I'm a bit odd that way. I mean, any traffic to our site, I welcome. So I mean, I'm really not the good example here, Con.
Yeah,
well, he is a good example in regards of that. Blacknight.xxx is currently forwarding to blacknight.com. Mm-hmm. And that is why it's not being picked up, because okay. we crawl only for .XXX names. So the quickest fix for McKaylee would be to mask the site and have it be blackknight.XXX.
Well, yeah. I have to say, Patrick, I'm used to searching on search engines and finding that you put in something innocent enough and you get porn links turn up in it, depending on the terminology that you've used. And this seems to be the opposite of that, in the sense that I put in a search term and nothing but porn comes up.
Exactly. So, currently, I mean, in Google right now, if you were to search for any even adult term, they'll probably start push. They're starting to do mixed results. Usually with the latest, I'm not a Google SEO connoisseur, but since the Panda and Penguin updates, a lot of people in the adult community have seen their sites being ranked further down the list and even further down some pages. So with .XXX, I mean, you're going to get exactly what you're looking for. I'm going to call it what it is, all porn and only porn.
Yeah, I mean, this is essentially, that's what your philosophy is, that's what your business premise is, Patrick. Is it fair to say this is the red light district, this is the area where this content is?
Search.XXX, yes, we want to give the user a great experience.
Yeah, yeah, and it's if that is the experience they're looking for. And equally, the other side of that, I suppose, and this is to do with the things like the MetaCert certification and things like that as well, if people don't want to see content like that, well, then they can be sure if they use those kind of databases and those kind of certification tools, they can be sure the .XXX content won't show up where it isn't wanted and will show up where it is wanted, is what you want, really, isn't it?
Of course, yeah. That's pretty much the premise of it. So far, we've been getting pretty good reviews, but as we were talking earlier, I hate to bring it back up, but well, maybe it's a good analogy, but when we were talking about the new Apple Maps platform, well, it's just not Google. It's just not there yet. Well, you know, give them time, they will be there. And I think that, you know, we've been working on this for quite some time now, but every day we're tweaking it and getting it better and better and better, and hopefully the user experience will... we're hoping that'll be first on their search engine. I mean, obviously with different platforms right now, Safari, for example, you can type in a search term and then it's saved in your search, you know, categories. You go to search.XXX, it's just one site and anything you can search for won't be saved.
What kind of learning has been involved here from the point of view of ICM Registry, Patrick? I mean, search is quite a specialized area, and people like Google and Bing are, you know, working on the science and the engineering and the technology of this all the time. Did you guys hire in some expertise to help you with this?
We had a couple of consultants, but for the most part, it was in-house. We had a lot of learning to do. A couple growing pains. I mean, we've been working on this probably for the most part of the year. So it was a big learning curve, but I think the team we have has done a phenomenal job, and you know, it's just going to get better.
Very good. You got any more questions there, Michele? I know there's some.
Oh, of course I do. Of course I do. Oh my God, I mean, we're getting to talk to about porn, and I'm getting, you know, this is work related. It's great.
We've got some user questions as well on the blog site as well. I'll let you bring those up also, Michele.
Oh, no, don't worry, I will. Give me a chance now. Let me get a word in edgeways, my God. Now, just looking at .XXX in general, obviously there's going to be lots of adult content, and let's call a spade, porn. But what about non-adult uses of .XXX? I mean, have you seen many of those? I mean, I can think of one very obvious one, but, you know, what has your experience been?
I don't know if you've seen the website Conan.XXX. Are you familiar with Conan O'Brien? He's probably
yes.
a fellow Irishman. Yeah, he launched a XXX site and basically puts these XXX parody videos of different search situations, and there was one that was put on about a couple weeks ago with Will Ferrell, and he
is this
did this
the like, Trampire one.
The which one?
Trampire.
No, he did the something like Big Dick Little Chicks. It's called. It's just basically where it's the title says it all, but it's basically Will Ferrell just being not very nice to these little chicks, and it was like the animals. So. It was funny, you know. That's how they just poke fun at things. And if you get a chance, you should check out Conan.XXX. So, yes, we do see some non-adult ones pop up here and there. And plus, you know, if They could also be, you know, we sold a premium name to a law firm in my Orlando a few months back that should be launching pretty soon. It's law.xxx. So it's, you know, a lawyer that represents the adult entertainment community.
Let me go back to Conan O'Brien there for a second, Patrick. You're saying there's no porn on this site, on the Conan.xxx site, is there?
No, it's more of a sort of a parody site.
So how does he meet your criteria then to be listed in .xxx or to have a .xxx domain?
Well, he provides products or services to the adult community. I mean, it's a pretty vague definition if you really want to come down to it. He can say, hey, who's to say that members of the sponsored community don't watch my show? Do I not provide them entertainment?
Okay. So
it's self-declaratory, Com.
Yeah, no.
Yes.
Okay. So no. Well, in that case, I'm calling into question. Does that not call into question the value of that declaration? Then, in that case, if, as you say, it's self-declaratory and it's subject to interpretation.
There's no interpretation, Con. You say you want a porn site.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, yeah. No. But I thought one of the things that you were offering was that there was all porn and nothing but porn on the site. But that's not the case either. No.
That is research.xxx.
Oh, I understand. Right.
Yes. So as a registry to be part of the sponsored community, you basically self-attest that you are a member of the sponsored community and you think that self-identification and labeling of sites is and you want to comply with our I4 policies. And part of our policy is to all your sites will be labeled as XXX. So if you want to block it, you can. And the other one is to keep the kids out of it. And those are the two policies set up right now in I4. I4 is the International Foundation for Online Responsibility that oversees our charter.
Okay, so if you say you're a member of the community, then you're a member of the community. I understand, and you,
yes,
yeah, okay.
I mean, it's not. I mean, Carl, it's pretty simple. I mean, look, if you think about it, you know, we're talking about porn here. I mean, and adult content. People aren't going to opt in to say that they're offering it unless they want to.
Fair enough.
But I mean, the other thing I suppose is, you know, why do you know, or maybe which we should really ask Stuart this, why does he choose .xxx and not .adult or .porn?
Well, Stuart spent a lot of time researching the subject when he went through this whole battle starting out in 2000, well, the first round, I believe, where it was declined, then the second round where he was initially approved. But, you know, just did a lot of research and, you know, and he found out in most countries, XXX only means one thing and one thing only. So it just made more sense to him to do that. You know, an adult, if you did a dot adult or dot porn or dot sex, they're spelled differently in different languages. XXX is only spelled one way. You know, if you don't get into IDNs or anything like that, but or actually in IDNs, yeah, it would work. So it was just a no-brainer to go with that one.
That's what makes sense. Now we got a couple of questions from our users and our public. One from Eileen Gallagher. What proportion of the domains do you expect will have e-commerce functionality in .xxx in general?
Is she referring to our payment platform that we're talking about launching?
No. Just people registering. Well, I think what she's asking is, when somebody registers a .xxx domain name, are they more likely to have some kind of online payment function there, or is this not relevant at all? I mean, are more pay-per-view sites using .xxx, I suppose, or pay-for-service sites using it?
Yes, it's actually a very healthy mix. You know, obviously, the whole idea of the adult world is to get you to pay for the content. Currently, there's a whole tube site epidemic where a lot of the content's just free, hindering a lot of people from actually breaking out their wallets and paying for things. So, the object is to get people to start paying for these types of sites. Next year, we're planning on launching our own payment product coming out, I'm not sure which quarter, but probably midway through. And where Stuart likes to call it, Stuart Lawley, the CEO of ICM, likes to call it a iTunes meets PayPal, where he wants to introduce a micropayment platform where all .xxx sites would effectively have micro clips on them where you could go on cross-platform to different sites and actually pay for it per clip, as opposed to giving one site your credit card information. You would actually just have a XXX account, and then every time you clicked on a clip, that money would be deducted from a XXX account, but you would use it at different sites. So it would only be one site, so you could surf as freely as you want to and not just be stuck with one company.
So it'd be a bit like one of these kind of network type things, but much, much bigger.
Yeah, we're hoping it becomes very, very big. Yeah, so, you know, and with the tube site epidemic, you know, there's so much content that's free for you to give a monthly subscription for $20 a month. It may be easier just for you to have one account, throw $20 in there total, and just go from site to site. And, yeah, there's a lot of free content, but I don't know, maybe if you're feeling frisky, you'd want to pay $1.99 to $2.99 for a clip that you haven't seen or you can't find on a tube site. We're willing to bet that there's quite a few people out there that would.
So with this, so you think that might lead to better quality content?
Sure. I mean, the content out there is pretty good at, you know, and every you know, these content producers come out with, you know, they're very innovative people, and they come out with some really quality stuff, and I imagine it's just going to get better. Yeah, absolutely.
Now, another question from James. Are any .XXX sites doing well in Google in terms of ranking in Google?
You know, that's sometimes yes, sometimes no. It's really, really weird. I mean, one day one of our webmasters was saying that he couldn't believe it. It was movies.xxx. It was literally on the first page of Google, and then you know, a couple weeks later, it dropped off the first page. So Google's been doing a lot of analytics. So I don't know too much about Google, but it's really, really interesting. But that's the case with a lot of webmasters. A lot of webmasters that have certain keywords, especially in the actual domain, they're seeing themselves getting dropped as well. So it's more about having fresh content quality. But I'm not a, you know, an SEO expert or anything like that. So I'm not really sure. I do know that if you type in certain sites, like if you type like a niche, so if you typed in a casting, so for casting is a type of niche where, you know, you can look it up. But if you type in casting, it'll just come up all different things for casting. But if you type in XXX casting, casting.xxx is number one on the site. So it's, you know, I don't have the algorithm, but I think in time when people start producing more quality content, we will see a lot more XXX sites listed in Google alone.
So at the moment, are you seeing a lot of people developing new sites under .XXX, or are they just switching or pointing the .XXXs at an existing .com?
Well, some of our best content are the people that are starting with fresh content on XXX and bought the great XXX keyword from us with the sole purpose of developing that site. That's probably the best content we have on some of our XXX sites. But then again, we do find that some people are running both sides because, like I said, you know, we're not here to compete with .com. You know, we're here to say, we're XXX, this is exactly what we have. And if you want people to find it, you can type in XXX at the end of the extension, and here we are. And with search.xxx, if we're sending a whole bunch of traffic through that portal, through the .xxx extension, why wouldn't you want that traffic? So it's just another way to bring traffic to your website at different eyeballs.
Well, fair enough. And one last question. This is from Kevin, Kevin Murphy of Domain Insight, who I'm sure you've met at some point in the past. Now, Kevin has a very particular question and has to be phrased in a particular way. Does the job have any perks? And he's put quotes around the perks. He wants the quotes in there.
Okay. You mean like matching 401k?
Well, he was just wondering. I think he's just waiting to get a rise out of you.
Oh, yeah. You know what? There's plenty of perks here. Obviously, there's the more of the business side, which is dealing with the registrar community, attending ICANN meetings and things like that. Mm-hmm. But we also do have the fun side of the business. And I have one of our VP of sales, Stephen Winyard. He could probably sit here for an hour and a half on a show discussing all great stories he's seen on the road at all the adult shows. Unfortunately, I don't get the opportunity to go to those. you know, Stuart doesn't think a married man like myself should be going to those things. So here I am, just going to the ICANN meetings. So,
well, that's an interesting, it's an interesting point, Patrick. I mean, do you see yourself as working in the porn industry?
Oh, absolutely not. You know, it's funny, when I was relocated to Florida, I was just selling this other technology dealing with biometric fingerprints. And after I got my MBA, I knew I wanted to get into healthcare. So I looked up healthcare companies in my area where I lived, because I just wanted to, you know, hit the streets and hit doctor's offices and see if they'd want to buy an electronic health record, or EMR, if you call it. And I Googled us Stuart Lawley's company. I found it, and Stuart owned this EMR company. So I went in, and the day before the interview, you want to research your would-be employer, and I looked up Stuart Lawley just to get some information on him. And the first article that popped up was the would-be porn king. And this was in 2008. So I interviewed for the job, and he hired me on as a sales rep. And then when I reported the work a couple days later or whatever, I went up to him. I'm like, you know, you should Google yourself. There's some interesting topics about you. I wasn't quite sure it was you, but after meeting you and seeing your picture, it's definitely you. And he's like, don't worry about that. And, you know, 2 years later, when he won the independent review panel, this was all going along while I was selling the electronic health records for him. He came in my office. He's like, oh, my God, we won. This is crazy. I can't believe it. And I was just like, well, you know, and I had no idea what a registry was. I owned my name only and .com. And I really didn't understand what .XXX was going to do or what it was for. So since 2010, obviously it took a whole nother year to actually be approved by ICANN in April 2011. And then we had to launch our product 6 months later. So basically I kept selling the electronic health records until January of 2011. And then for the next 3 months, it was pretty much Stuart's good graces and the rest of us on payroll, just to keep us on payroll. We had to take a little bit of pay cuts here and there just to, you know, keep the lights on and things like that, because there was no more revenue coming in. But we just knew that this could be a really big opportunity. So how did I get in the industry? Well, I just cold called Stuart Lawley one day and kind of just fell into it. So to decide between selling electronic health records and a registry business, that seemed like a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. I chose the registry business, and it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, but I suppose what my question is boiled down to really, Patrick, is it's a registry business, sure, but it's not just a registry business. It's a very specific registry for a very specific kind of content. And I suppose what I'm wondering is, you know, have you had, what kind of reaction have you had perhaps from family and friends, you know, to your work in this area? Or has it been, you know, has it been interesting from that point of view?
Yeah, completely interesting. I mean, when I go out with friends, I mean, I don't even have to tell anyone what I do. It's basically murmured around the table before I get there. And then the topic always comes up. So, Pat, what do you do? And then I have to, you know, just basically just tell them, yeah, I'm in the adult, whatever business, because it's basically that's what they're waiting for me to say, because it's already been brought up. But around family conversations, you know, my family is very supportive of what I do. I don't hide from it. They think it's a really good idea. I think it's a great idea. If I didn't, I wouldn't be here. So it's, it's actually well received from all aspects of both sides of the family and friends.
Good. No, interesting to know, as I say, and that was a question definitely I felt I had to ask. There's another question we have there, Michele. I'm not sure I understand it. I'm going to leave it to you about the TLD apps.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I suppose there's a couple of things. First off, ICM has applied for a number of other extensions. I think .adult was one, .porn was another, there might have been a third. Brain not working very well. What's the thinking there?
Well, in the new GTLD program, we applied for three additional ones. We applied for .sex, .adult, and .porn. And it was more along the lines of a brand protection side on our angle, and we wanted to protect .XXX registrants. So, for example, we sold the domain gay.xxx last year for $500,000. So we didn't want the person that put that kind of capital into that kind of domain to feel like, oh, man, we have other adult extensions coming out. Now I have to go buy gay.adult, gay.porn, or gay.sex. So we wanted to apply for them and effectively put the names that are already registered with .xxx on our reserve list so no one else could get them. So if you registered domain.xxx, the corresponding domain.sex, domain.porn, and domain.adult would be just put on a reserve list free of charge whatsoever. And if the registrant wants the names, there'll be a small charge that they can go register the names. We'll probably have a wholesale price of $10 to $12. And, so we're basically saying you're getting four TLDs for the price of one. But it was strictly just to protect our sponsor community from feeling like they had to purchase other domains.
That's interesting. So you're looking after the people who registered the domain names. That's important for your business model and for the sustainability long term, I think, of it, Patrick, it's fair to say. And, of course, your job is registrar liaison. So what do you got to do to keep people like Michele happy?
I attend the ICANN meetings, have our I'll take them out to lunch and, try to pamper them up a little bit and see if I can get, ranked a little higher. Currently, I look at his website now and XXX is the last one there. So I got to meet with him in Toronto and see if I can get that beefed up a little bit quicker.
Is he that? And is it as easy as taking him out to lunch? Is he that easy, Patrick?
Michele likes lunch, I like it too. And he's great conversation, especially Michele likes a beer too. And I like to indulge in that with him as well.
Good stuff. Well, it's been very interesting talking to you, Patrick. Michele, I think this is last week was our longest ever. I think we've broken that record again.
We're gonna poor Pat. I feel sorry for him. I mean, we should have warned him that once we get started, it's very hard to stop. And I'm sorry, Patrick. I do apologize.
No, don't apologize. It's been a lot of fun for sure.
Patrick Donaldson, thanks for joining us this week on technology.ie. This is me, Conor Mwinachon, saying bye for now.
I'm Michele Nalum.
Okay.
I'm
not even sure who I am anymore. God.
That's it. Right. Until next week, Slongafore.